Hello, I'm Andy Burnham. Welcome to Sparks. This week, TV3 in Ireland lose their franchise. Japanese research into 3D television. A review of a new guide to shortwave listening. High-tech video rental via satellite. And a telephone renumbering farce that's on the cards soon. Digital audio broadcasting in the FM band in the United States, and an AES report on analog FM modulation levels. And remember Radio Free America. All today on Sparks. Radio fax is on 6205 12255 and 3910.
Got a black magic woman. Got a black magic woman. Yes, I got a black magic woman. Got me so blind I can't see. That she's a black magic woman and she's trying to make a devil out of me. Don't turn your back on me, baby. Don't turn your back on me, baby. Yes, don't turn your back on me, baby. You're messing around with your tricks. Don't turn your back on me, baby, 'cause you might just break up my magic spell. Spell on me, baby. You got your spell on me, baby. Yes, you got your spell on me, baby. Turning my heart into stone. I need you so bad, magic woman. I can't leave you alone. Yes, I need you so bad.
Japanese research focusing on 3D television by Mike Galbraith in Asia Pacific Broadcasting. Solid state materials for future broadcast systems, 3D TV without the need for special glasses, and 55-inch screens for HD TV in the home. These are some of the items on the agenda of Japan's NHK research teams. These research items fall into the category of future broadcast systems, the other two areas in NHK's research activities being studies for the implementation of new broadcasting media and the improvement of existing systems. Solid-state materials include LSIs, large-scale integrated circuits for broadcasting, and new materials for signal processing, recording and display. Work is also being done on the ability of future broadcast satellites to broadcast a continual bit stream of multiple information signals on a packet basis. The concept is called Integrated Service Digital Broadcasting. Researchers are also studying the human pulse in an effort to learn how the brain recognizes information, seeing this as a key to designing future broadcast services and better program production. Work on super surround audio video, or 3D television, is also being done as NHK looks beyond high-definition television. While other leading advanced countries are still racing to develop HD TV technologies, NHK has been broadcasting 1 hour a day of its high-definition Hi-Vision programmes since June 1989, and is planning to expand this to 4 to 8 hours a day from the end of this year, when its next satellite is launched. In fact, NHK first demonstrated high-definition television in the US as far back as 1981. NHK's achievements stem principally from the work done in the NHK laboratories at Kinuta, on the outskirts of Tokyo. But, said Taji Nishiwaza, deputy director of NHK's science and technical research laboratories, "I think our most exciting current project is the flat plasma display panel project." He explained how a 33-inch screen was demonstrated last year, followed by a 40-inch prototype this year at the National Association of Broadcasters exhibition. The new prototype can only display test patterns, but next year NHK plans to have the 40-inch screen with normal television pictures. "Our target is 55-inch diameter screens for home viewing of high-definition television." Although he was reluctant to make a prediction, he suggested a time frame of 5 to 7 years before commercialization. "The mechanical structure of PDP is very simple. We can make them using printing technology." He explained that the rival LCD technology was based on integrated circuit technology, and therefore he expected PDPs to be cheaper to make. He said another good feature of PDP technology was the ability to make a very large direct view display, up to 55 inches in diameter. But PDP technology is slow to come to the marketplace because the problem is the lifespan of a PDP display. So far, researchers had only been able to develop PDPs with a current life of 2,000 hours, or 1 year if it were to be kept in operation for 5 hours a day. "We would like to extend the lifetime to 10,000 hours. NHK expects stereoscopic television to be the main broadcasting service of the 21st century. NHK claims it has the world's first large-size colour 3D LCD, and demonstrated a 50-inch 3D television system with a 16:9 aspect ratio at its annual open day in Kinuta. The television has a projection-type display with 3 metres distance between the LC panel and the 3D screen. By introducing deflector mirrors, NHK expects to be able to eventually have models ready for home use. The system uses 4 cameras, and while NHK researchers believe 8 cameras are necessary, they are working on compressing the bandwidth substantially. Researchers are not carrying out their research programs in a vacuum. They work closely with the R&D teams of leading Japanese electronics companies. In the 3D TV project, the LC panel studies are done together with Sanyo Electric researchers, and the 3D screen was developed in conjunction with Toppan Printing. While NHK holds the total system patents, Sanyo Electric has the patents relating to the liquid crystal panel, for example. The technologies developed in NHK's labs are thus transferred to manufacturers for commercialization. The manufacturers are not always Japanese either. Texas Instruments, Motorola, and LSI Logic are among the companies that are recipients of NHK's know-how in HDTV satellite broadcasting technology. NHK's science and technical research labs were established in 1930, 5 years after NHK, the Japanese state broadcaster itself. "We think it's very important for NHK to have its own labs because we know the requirements of our producers and our viewers," Nishiwaza said. "There are many labs in the plants of manufacturing companies, but we think that our position as a broadcaster is the best one to carry out R&D for the future. In fact, NHK is required by Japan's broadcasting law to carry out R&D activities. Its R&D budget is part of the total NHK budget, which has to be approved by the Diet every year. NHK is financed solely by license fees from its viewers." This year, the NHK laboratories have a budget of about 3 billion yen. That's roughly $2 million, excluding the cost of salaries. Research into broadcasting in Japan there by Mike Galbraith from Asia Pacific Broadcasting.
Everybody's trying to tell me what is right for me, yeah. I need a drink and a quick decision. Now it's up to me who will be. She's gone. She's gone. Oh, I better learn how to face it. She's gone. She's gone. Devil to replace her.
She's gone.
And she's gone.
Oh, I, what went wrong?
Get up in the morning, look in the mirror. My mom has a toothbrush hanging in the stand. Yeah. My face ain't looking any younger. She's gone. Oh, I, what went wrong? Think I'll spend eternity in the city. Let the carbon and monoxide choke my thoughts away. Your pretty body's as helped as our memories. They can never be what she was to me. She's gone.
She's gone.
Oh, I better learn how to face it.
She's gone.
She's gone.
Oh, I
pay the devil to replace her.
She's gone.
And she's gone.
Radio New York International, the people who operated from the MV Sarah for a short period off New York, have transmissions occasionally coming out of Costa Rica. Here's one of their programs where they're reminiscing about another offshore station which operated for a short time in the States.
Because I remember, I don't know if you remember this, do you remember back, I think it was in 1973, when the Reverend Carl McIntyre put a radio ship off the coast of Cape May, New Jersey. I don't know how you remember anything about radio ships. I mean, you don't know anything about radio ships, do you now? Do you remember that?
Yeah, I remember it quite well.
He was on 1160.
Right.
And at the time, he didn't have a Jerry Turo to get annoyed at. He had KSL in Salt Lake City get annoyed at him.
Well, the reason he went to a ship, I know we're going on a little bit of a side, but this is the radio hour, is he got in trouble with the Commission on the Fairness Doctrine. Remember the old Fairness Doctrine? And he got his licenses revoked. And he said to himself, oh, this, you know, I'm not going to deal with this. And he chartered a ship and put put like a 10,000 watt AM transmitter on it. Went on, what did you say,
1160.
Yeah. I think they were able to pump out about 8 kilowatts.
That was before Cuba put on their 500,000 watt. Oh my God.
Right. And this was in 1973, and they went off the coast of Cape May, but they called themselves Radio Free America. And Pirate Joe and I, at that time, we drove down there.
This I haven't heard.
Oh, okay. Yeah. No, we drove down there, like to Cape May, New Jersey, on a hot, you know, late summer day. I forgot exactly when it was, but we saw this in the news, and we said, wow, this guy's got a radio ship. You know, let's go down and help him out. So we got in his 1953 Plymouth, and we drove down to Cape May, New Jersey. This was around, you know, circa 1973, late summer of 73. And we get to this place called the Christian Admiral, which was this huge 1920s hotel. I mean, this hotel went from one end of the boardwalk to the other. It was right on the ocean. And that was in the early 70s when you know, that whole Cape May Atlantic City area was kind of a little bit run down.
Right.
You know,
before they legalized gambling.
Right, before they legalized gambling. So we get there, and there's this huge, you know, old hotel, kind of a little bit decrepit inside, but open. And a big banner, a big, you know, cloth banner over the front, you know, archway of the hotel that says Radio Free America.
Oh, no.
And Pirate Show and I go in there, and we walk up to the table, and we go, hi, we want to help you get on the air and stay on the air. And they treated us well for 2 days. They put us up, you know, they sat us down. We met with the captain. We met with all the people involved. We never got to go out to the ship.
Right.
But our advice to them is that if you go on 1160, you're going to interfere with all kinds of domestic AM stations, and the government is going to really get uptight. But if you go on 1620 AM, which is a little bit above the AM broadcast band, which a lot of pirates do today, if you go above that, you will have an opportunity to say what you want to say. And unfortunately, after that we left, after about a day or so, we left, we went back to New York, they went on the air. They immediately got a restraining order slapped against them for two reasons. First, they were interfering with, what was it, KOI?
KSL.
KSL.
Yeah.
That's their insult rate for the city.
Right.
They were interfering with them. And also, they were broadcasting on an American registered ship.
Oh, no.
And we told them that
fatal error.
Yeah, we told them that was a mistake. I mean, you got the right ship, but it's the wrong registry. You need to And at that time, if McIntyre had registered the ship with Panama, or had leased a Panamanian registered, you know, a freighter, and put his signal on there, they wouldn't have been able to do anything. You know, that time things were a little more lax, and we didn't have the Bush Reagan dynasty, and he probably would have been able to go on 1620 with probably not too much trouble. You know, with the government feeling that they own the world. But anyway, Captain Radio, I'm sorry that I'm taking you time.
Okay.
You know, if you just tuned in, this is Radio New York International. We're talking with Captain Radio now about radio and this long overdue program.
Al Weiner and the gang there from Radio New York International.
The first week of the new year, we heard a mystery pirate on 819 kHz AM, running a two-hour tape of 70s rock music, including Rainbow, Rush and Hawkwind. This tape ran for the entire week. There was a short ID as The Edge, but no mailing address or phone number. They're obviously not out for an ego trip, so what are they up to? We traced their transmissions to a 10-watt VMOSFET-based transmitter at the base of a tower block in central London, with a quarter-wave aerial up the side of the block. They managed an excellent signal from their site, being receivable throughout the M25 area. On FM in London, Green Apple are reported the same week. According to Kevin Thorpe, their transmissions started off over-deviated and there was a break of 5 minutes, followed by a period of lower signal strength and correct mod. Half an hour later, they went off for another few minutes and then came on with the over-deviated signal again and a higher signal strength. Kevin suggests they may be switching between two transmitters in different sites, a distinct possibility. So, hello to Daniel Busman from Solothurn in Switzerland. He's listening on a Kenwood R5000 with a 40-metre long wire and sends a good postcard of his town. And M. Jones writes from Cheltenham in Gloucestershire. I tuned in tonight and heard you both on 6205 and 3910, which was much better due to a clear channel. 6205 was never very good. Wishing you all the best. And all the best back to Mr. M. Jones. You're listening to Sparks on Radio Fax. Every Monday and Tuesday, our weekly programme of technical, scientific and media news. If you'd like to write, the address is Sparks, Radio Fax, The Forge, Cranley, England, GU6 7BG. And if you enclose 50 pence, 3 international reply coupons or $1, you'll get back our station card, including technical information and an artist's impression of the transmitter site. That address, Sparks, Radio Fax, The Forge, Cranley, England, GU6 7BG. And even if you can't stretch to the postage, I'll certainly say hello to you on air and read out your letter. Now, here's a strange request. Well, it's quite an important request for us. Do you have any 813 valves kicking around in your junk box? And if so, would you like to see them going to a good use? Well, at Radio Fax, we've been running so long and so successfully that we've run out of 813 spares. Because, as you probably know, they tend to go bang occasionally if the aerial falls down or just through general wear and tear. So, we have run out of 813 valves, and if you'd like to see your valves go to a good use, if you wrap them up well and send them to the usual address, we will, by return, refund your postage and basically be very grateful. So, it doesn't matter if you're not sure what condition they're in, we can test them, and they'll get sent out and go to very good use, because buying new 813s, as I'm sure you know, is very expensive. So if you could help us out, we would be much grateful. Doctor in the house.
Doctor Ray. Doctor Ray. We've got a hot one for you. Can you take care of it? We've got a hot one for you. Can you take care of it?
Plastic Man.
Listen for the big bop.
He just mangled
a wicked plastic man.
A Dutch firm seeks backers for satellite-based video rental service. By Junko Yoshida in Tokyo, an Amsterdam-based company hopes to launch a digitally compressed video rental service to be delivered by satellite in Japan by 1993. The company, Entertainment Made Convenient International, is negotiating with several Japanese companies to launch the project. It aims to transmit programs efficiently enough to serve 1 million households. EMC said it has 7 engineers based in Palo Alto, California, working with scientists at Iterated Systems, Inc. in Norcross, Georgia, to develop a full-motion video compression-decompression chip. The chip would be the heart of a black box consumers would attach to their TVs. Instead of popular discrete cosine transform techniques, EMC is using Integrated Systems fractal geometry technology, descriptions of images in equations, to retain the original picture quality and to achieve more effective compression. The companies plan to compress full motion video images at the rate of 3 megabytes per second. Michael Barnsley, president of Iterated Systems, said EMC is contributing digital-to-analog conversion and error code checking technology needed for secure modem transmission to the project. The company has already reached an understanding with several studios that is based on royalty payments for each viewer who rents a movie. The studios have agreed to provide their films with no extra advances to EMC, said William A. Graven, the founder. The biggest problem now faced is finding manufacturers to make black boxes. EMC originally approached practically all of the Japanese VCR manufacturers, as well as Philips and Thompson. The idea was to sell EMC as a marketing catalyst for home-use digital VCRs, which have yet to be standardized and introduced to the market. Japanese manufacturers agreed that a VCR that goes digital would not be a good enough reason for consumers to replace their old machines, Graven said. But if every digital VCR is equipped with an EMC decompression chip as a feature for reception of the electronic video rental service, we thought a new digital VCR could be very attractive. The negotiations with Japan's major electronics makers continued until this past spring. However, the final word from them was, "We can't do it yet because there is no digital VCR standard in the industry." Practically every company in the consumer electronics industry is said to have its own digital format under the table, but no formal meetings or efforts to standardize the next generation digital home VCR have emerged so far. EMC's idea is wonderful, and the hardware will probably work, said an executive at one of the Japanese VCR manufacturers. But this is by far a bigger project than they are actually thinking of. It's too early for us to join in. That in Electronics World News, and I wonder how much dreaming is in that and how much actual technology. And the Japanese reckon it can be done. I'm not so sure, but I remain to be convinced.
down all over me. I'm bathing in red rain coming down. Red rain is coming down. Red rain is coming down all over me. I'm begging you.
Peace in Radio World by Steve Crowley in Washington about digital audio broadcasting. Though the Eureka 147 digital audio broadcasting system emerged first and foremost, other DAB systems have been proposed in the United States, designed to operate in the FM band. All differ greatly from the Eureka scheme. Why bother developing new systems when Eureka already exists? There are about 11,000 radio stations in the US, about 6,000 FM and 5,000 AM. Most are privately owned and supported by the sale of advertising. There are about 1,500 FM stations that do not carry commercials and are supported by private donations and varying degrees of government support. In general, FM stations are in better financial shape than AM stations because of their better audio quality and larger audiences. FM stations can sell for tens of millions of dollars, while some AM stations can be bought simply by taking over their debts. Indeed, about 250 licensed AM stations are now not operating because they cannot afford to. Those who have paid a large amount of money for an FM station do not want to see the AM stations have equal audio quality as they might with a Eureka-type DAB system. It seems the companies with heavy investments in FM stations are leading the move towards in-band systems. A second major concern is spectrum. The Eureka system needs a large, exclusive allocation of spectrum to accommodate all US broadcasters. Over one-third of the US frequency bands below 1,000 MHz are used by broadcasting. It is hard to justify more, especially if digital technology can be used to reuse the FM band. Some broadcasters are afraid that if any spectrum is released at L-band, it will be a small amount. Since the unfavorable propagation characteristics of L-band may not allow an economically viable terrestrial DAB system, the new L-band frequencies may go to the satellite users. US broadcasters, especially FM operators, see an in-band system as solving these problems. Theoretically, FM stations would get DAB capacity in the FM band, and AM stations would get capacity in the AM band. The AM band problem is technically much more difficult than the FM problem, which may make it necessary for AM stations to take advantage of additional capacity in the FM band. A paradox of the AM concern is that as ways of accommodating them in the FM band are investigated, those FM stations pushing for an in-band solution may find AM stations as equal digital competitors in the FM band. There are now six US in-band proponents, most of which are on the West Coast. Kintel Technologies has received patents for a technology to place a DAB signal underneath an existing FM signal. It is about 25 dB below the FM signal's power to minimize interference to the FM signal. A special digital receiver is needed to cancel out the FM signal and extract the digital information. Digital Radio's research in Project Acorn continues. Technical details are sketchy of their system, but it is designed to place a DAB signal underneath or adjacent to an FM signal. Lincoln Corporation has developed a number of digital technologies applicable to DAB, such as universal modem integrated circuits. Synetcom Digital System uses the existing subcarrier region of an FM station to carry digital audio data. American Digital Radio is developing a system that would take advantage of frequency diversity to alleviate the multipath problem. It would operate on channels in between existing FM stations. And the final contender is Mercury Digital Communications Incorporated, which has conducted research into developing modulation techniques that would place DAB signals adjacent to FM signals. And then the seventh proponent outside the US is the Eureka 147 project itself. Because of the uncertainty of obtaining new spectrum in the US for DAB, the National Association of Broadcasters has asked the Eureka project to investigate development of an in-band system. The in-band proponents face the challenge of placing robust DAB signals in the existing broadcast bands without significantly degrading existing analog services. None of the existing proposed systems has been tested in a mobile environment, an essential step before one can be adopted as a standard. That piece by Steve Crowley. Of course, the Eureka and the British Digital Audio Broadcasting System is the only one which has been tested in a mobile environment, and the only one really likely to work properly.
You're listening to Sparks on Radio Facts, this week presented by Andy Burnham and Trevor Brook. A nation renumbered? In Communications Networks magazine, Ken Young considers the announcement by Oftel to rearrange our telephone numbering system by adding an extra digit in Easter 1994. I am not a number, I'm a free man, or so the Prisoner TV series told us back in the 1960s. Despite the Prisoner's theatrical attempt to alert us back to the Kafkaesque nature of modern life, we are, most of us, free or not, identified by one or more numbers. The recent announcement by Oftel has focused attention on the importance of numbering and stirred considerable debate. Londoners, more than most, will be somewhat perplexed by the intended number change, after having split from 01 to 071 and 081 last year. It is totally unnecessary. The current usage of numbers is totally inefficient, said Richard Cox, principal consultant of Cardiff-based Mandarin Technology. Cox says that current usage of the possible number configurations is a measly 3 or 4%, which equates to 23 million numbers in use. Cox believes this could be brought closer to 40% if numbers not in use were reallocated. Richard Cox would be something of a lone voice, if not for the fact that his concerns are shared by the Telecommunications Managers Association, which feels that further research should have been carried out before deciding on the new numbering. As you might expect, there are financial interests at stake. Cox claims that the losers will be users, who will have to pay for new stationery, software modifications to telephone exchanges, payphones, smart boxes, and reprogramming of computers and fax machines. The TMA is concerned with the potential cost of the changes and the problems of harmonisation with Europe. David Harrington, Director General of the Telecommunication Managers Association, said some organisations may be faced with three code changes in less than 3 years. Here he refers to the possibility that a pan-European 15-digit scheme will be introduced around 1996. If the number change does run into trouble with the pan-European plans, there is likely to be a certain amount of buck passing among those responsible. Bearing in mind the comment in the Ovum consultancy report commissioned by Oftel that we could easily carry on for another 10 years with the current numbering, the hindsight may well prove the wait-and-see lobby to be right. That in Communications Networks magazine.
You are number six. signed. I will not be pushed, filed, stamped, indexed, briefed, debriefed, or numbered. My life is my own. I resign.
Orange alert.
Don't understand, have to listen to your demand. But I'll tell you why I resign. Ha! Change your mind.
You are number six. Number six. I am not a number. I am not a number. You are number six. Number six.
I am not a number. I am a free man.
You are number six.
This week on Sparks, TV3 in Ireland lose their franchise. Japanese research into 3D television. A review of a new guide to shortwave listening. High-tech video rental via satellite. Telephone renumbering farce is on the cards. Digital audio broadcasting in the FM radio band in the United States. And an AES report on analog FM modulation levels. And remember Radio Free America. You're listening to Sparks.
In the American publication Radio World, a review of the 1992 edition of the book Passport to World Band Radio by Frank Beecham. It is that time of year again for World Band Radio buffs. The 1992 edition of Passport to World Band Radio has hit the bookshelves, and once again, it does not disappoint. This year's book, in the aftermath of the Persian Gulf War and the Soviet coup, offers advice on crisis listening, picks the best world band programmes and the most powerful stations, and gives the novice a step-by-step guide on how to get started listening to international broadcasts. The book is loaded with plain language, information on just about every aspect of world band radio. Unlike many of the radio hobby magazines written in an insider's lingo, this is a book for the average listener or non-technical person who wants to discover a new and exciting pastime. My first experience with shortwave radio listening was in the 1950s, when, as a child, I saved every bit I could to purchase a pre-assembled mail-order shortwave radio called the Knight Space Spanner. When the radio arrived, I carefully set it up, strung the antenna between a couple of tall trees, and settled down to monitor the heavens. All I ever received was squeals and static. That disappointment carried over until my adult years. Until about 3 years ago, I discovered the annual Passport to World Band Radio book. It was the single influence that lured me back to world band listening, and I have been there ever since. When I spoke to the editor of the book, Lawrence Magny, this month, I learned that we had shared a similar youthful experience. Larry had saved all of his money while in college to purchase a Heathkit shortwave radio. I put it together with love and care, and it didn't work very well, Larry recalled. The bottom line was everything was right, but it was just a lousy piece of equipment. I never forgot that. I felt totally ripped off, and there was no place with any information on the subject. It was from this experience that the seed for the Passport book and one of its most popular features was planted. The equipment reviews of Passport, scathing to manufacturers of inferior equipment, is the most authoritative and exhaustive available anywhere on world band receivers. If you want love, get it at home, because you won't get it from radio equipment manufacturers, Larry said, with the tone of a man who has taken much heat through the years. In an article in the 1992 edition, titled Mothers, Don't Let Your Sons Grow Up to Test Radios, Larry lets his readers in on the price one must pay to criticise the designs of some of the world's most powerful electronics manufacturers. But he contends the grief is well worth it. Over time, valid reviews help diminish the presence of mediocre products within the marketplace while boosting the chances of superior models. Advertiser-oriented reviews appear to have little such impact. He adds that knowingly impugned truth offends me, and readers aren't fools. It is clear that 1991 has been a banner year for World Band Radio. Passport sold 80,000 copies last year, 20,000 of those in 1 2-week period during the Persian Gulf War. World Band Radio is becoming a nice niche field in broadcasting, Larry told us. There are two reasons for this. One is that television news is suffering from budget cuts, which is resulting in less worthy newscasts. Second, people are finding that World Band Radio offers a variety of perspectives on news events. When you dial up World Band, he continued, you get a choice of many different ideas that help in shaping opinion. Improved World Band radio receivers, a freeing up of spectrum space, and relay swaps between broadcasters also are resulting in a bigger World Band audience. For example, if Radio Japan is trying to reach the east coast of North America, they have a tough time doing it from Tokyo. The Canadians may be trying to reach Asia, and they are having a tough time doing it from New Brunswick. So they get together and use satellites to feed programs back and forth to each other and swap airtime. It's very cost-effective, and it results in an expanded audience. So says Larry Magny, editor of this book, Passport to World Band Radio, reviewed there by Frank Beecham in Radio World.
And you can look for that book in suitable retail outlets throughout the world. It may be ordered direct from the publisher at IBS Box 300, Penns Park, Pennsylvania 18943, USA, or phone 1-215-794-8252 in the USA, and the price varies depending on the shipping cost.
TV3 Losers franchise in Ireland. Piece by Neville Farmer. The first fully independent television channel has lost its franchise in Ireland only months before going on air. TV3 chairman and head of the Windmill Lane studio and production group, James Morris, was said to be shocked by the Irish government's decision. But the Independent Television and Radio Commission chief executive, Michael O'Keefe, said that the withdrawal was because the commission believed that the channel's consortium had effectively ceased to exist. He also believed that the consortium had failed to meet the August deadline for disclosure of investors and amounts of investment. TV3 was to be funded by the Windmill Lane group of companies, Paul McGuinness and Ossie Kilkenny, U2's manager and accountant, the Jefferson Smurfit Group, and Yorkshire Television. But continuous changes of tack by the Irish government caused nervousness amongst the investors. The original refusal of the government to issue a franchise without information about investors had caused deadlock, because some potential partners would not commit until the franchise was granted. But the real problem lay in the government's capping of the established Irish channel, RTE. The capping of its advertising revenue was aimed at providing a fund to give independent radio and television channels a fair start. This was later overturned, causing further concern amongst TV3 investors. The Irish government say that although it has withdrawn the franchise, the door is still open for another channel, and the franchise will be re-offered once the government has finalised its broadcast policy. It may even offer it to TV3, if it still exists. By Neville Farmer in ProSound News. And a short piece in Hardware's UK Network. Talk back in NICAM from TVAM. TVAM has become the first television company in the UK to build a system using the spare capacity within the NICAM audio signal to carry an additional speech channel. The new system, TIN, Talkback in NICAM, will allow reverse sound to outside broadcasts in areas with stereo television sound, cutting out the need for telephones or special circuits, and leading to a considerable increase in operational efficiency. Although the system currently carries only one voice channel, it has the capacity to carry a second, which could be used to provide a commentary for the blind. Hidden talkback sound there in the NICAM feed coming out of TVAM.
Here's a letter from Yari Van Hatterlo. I live in city of Oulu, population of 100,000 people, situated in map of in central part of Finland, but in practical northern part of Finland. In whole Finland, it is only about 5 million people, and most of the people live in the southern part of Finland. North of Oulu live only about 300,000 people. So a very northerly dweller. He's 30 years old, he writes, and works in a firm with computers. In my free time, I don't play any more with computers, but my favourite hobbies are sport, music, history, and listening to foreign radio stations. I have listened to these since 1974 and found it very interesting. At first, I listened with my grandfather's old tube receiver, strong stations from Europe, but then after some years, I noticed that with better radio and a long antenna, you can listen to programs from all over the world. During the last years, I have studied rather much solar activity, geomagnetic fields, local sunrise and other theory that helps to pick up local radio stations with little power. This was the first time I picked up your programme on 3910, and the reception quality is very good, with no interference. Thanks to Jari Van Hatterlo, writing from Finland. Hello also to David Ansell, living in Horsham in Sussex, thanks for your note. And Peter Lloyd, from Electricars, reports 3910, a great improvement on 6205 at night. Well, I'd agree with that. If you'd like to write to us, the address is Sparks, Radio Fax, The Forge, Cranley, England, GU6, 7BG. If you send 50 pence, 3 international reply coupons, or $1, we'll send you our station card, which includes technical information and an artist's impression of the transmitter site. However, even if you don't send anything, I'll read your name out on air and some of your letter. So the address again, Sparks, Radio Fax, The Forge, Cranley, England, GU6, 7BG. The Audio Engineering Society British section celebrated its 21st birthday on Tuesday the 12th of November last year with a lecture from Eric Small, president of Modulation Sciences Inc. in the USA, on the controversial subject of controlling and monitoring modulation levels in FM radio broadcasting. Immediately apparent was the striking contrast between the situation in an American city such as Los Angeles and that in, say, London. Mr. Small highlighted the fact that many tens of stations would normally compete for space in a crowded FM band in the States, and that in London he had noticed the relatively sparse packing of band too. Because of the competition between radio stations in the States, there is widespread use of devices such as OptiMod, offering even greater optimization of modulation levels, in an attempt to make the station the loudest on the block. Not only that, but if a cheap radio is to capture such closely packed stations, it is advantageous for a channel to be fully modulated most of the time. Using graphs of modulation level against likelihood of occurrence, Eric Small showed the difference between three FM stations in LA, one carrying middle-of-the-road music, one carrying classical, and another carrying rock music, illustrating clearly how the rock station achieved near-maximum modulation most of the time, with a large peak in occurrence of around 98% modulation. He said that this was the most popular station in LA, and that perhaps this demonstrated that people didn't care about the sonic effects of squashing and squeezing on broadcast sound. The graph for the classical station showed a much broader spread of modulation levels over time, without the large bunching towards the maximum end of the scale. Eric suggested that manufacturers of modulation optimization devices had to do the best they could whilst still meeting local regulatory conditions concerning peak modulation levels. But he pointed out that the measurement of almost instantaneous peak deviation was a poor guide to the reality of inter-channel interference and distortion. Preferable, he said, was to measure the occupied bandwidth integrated over a period of time, which gave a more useful guide to potential problems. The problem with this was that it would be computationally more intensive. He compared occupied bandwidth measurements for the three stations mentioned with peak deviation results, showing the greater degree of correlation in cases of longer integration of peak deviation measurements. He showed how in some stations' cases there was a large difference in result between the two methods of measurement. Questions from the floor concerned the advisability of heavy modulation optimization in the light of the potential effects on sound quality. And Eric Small, although sympathising with the view, suggested that commercial reality did not support such a stance. It was suggested that the battle for ever more efficient use of bandwidth was a vicious spiral from which no one could extricate themselves for fear of not being heard, and that it was the program directors who insisted upon the use of optimization systems. With digital audio broadcasting in the wind, one member suggested that the problem might go away before long, since bandwidth occupancy and loudness would no longer be related. But this would not prevent the use of compression for the sake of simple loudness competition. Yes, compression, the bane of our lives on FM broadcasting. Some of them are truly chronic, and in particular, Radio 1, Capital FM and KISS have particularly awful compression. Francis Rumsey, reporting from the AES British Section meeting last November.
From your love, You take my breath away. So please don't go. Don't leave me here all by myself. I get ever so lonely from time to time. Take my breath away.
In Microwaves and RF magazine, antenna glitches imperil the goals of the space program. Faulty antenna systems on 7 recent spacecraft have prompted NASA to re-evaluate its test needs. Clashing with the conventional wisdom that it is not always possible to test deployment of spacecraft antenna and solar arrays in ground tests because of limitations in simulating a microgravity environment, is a series of critical and near-critical failures by spaceborne antenna systems over the past 2 years. In all, 7 spacecraft have suffered. Anik E2, Galileo, the Gamma Ray Observatory, the Hubble Space Telescope, Magellan, Ulysses, and the Upper Atmosphere Research Satellite. At stake are decades of planning, billions of taxpayer dollars, and in a real sense, confidence in the space program. Michael Kakmar, writing in Microwaves and RF. Galileo and Ulysses remain jeopardized by their hardware malfunctions. NASA's Galileo was launched at Jupiter from the Space Shuttle in October 1989. In April 1991, its 4.8-meter high-gain antenna failed to deploy properly. Engineers at the Jet Propulsion Laboratory have determined that 3 of the antenna's 18 graphite epoxy ribs were bent by the drive mechanism as the unit was unfurled, leaving it partway open and useless. Several causes for the failure have been advanced, including exposed adhesive tape, wayward epoxy, mishandling during ground transportation, and insufficient lubricant. NASA technicians first attempted to free the jammed ribs by basking the antenna structure in sunlight, hoping critical components would expand. That effort failed, so the agency's current plan is to supercool the antenna's aluminium beryllium center structure in December, when Galileo moves farther away from the sun. At risk is most of the information Galileo will collect about Jupiter in its flyby 4 years from now. Instead of the antenna's intended data rate of 134 kilobits per second, images will travel at 10 bits per second, far too slow to fulfill the hopes of scientists for long looks at the Jovian planet, its magnetosphere, and its satellites. Solar exploration is the goal of Ulysses, launched by NASA and the European Space Agency in October 1990 after delays worthy of its namesake mythical wanderer. In this case, an unruly axial boom carrying sensors caused the spacecraft to wobble, which in turn prevented technicians from properly pointing the communications antenna. As the beam cooled, the problem corrected itself. With the craft approaching the Sun for its planned rendezvous in 1994, NASA engineers fear the problem could return. Antenna problems on the Hubble Space Telescope were dwarfed by the well-publicized flaws in its main mirror. To complicate matters, a high-gain antenna aboard the spacecraft became entangled in a loose cable, reducing the antenna's RF performance. Following the Hubble fiasco, Senator Al Gore, chairman of the Commerce Subcommittee on Science, Technology and Space, asked the General Accounting Office to review NASA's testing activities. In accepting the recommendations of the report, NASA has recognized the need to improve its testing. Its Office of Safety and Mission Quality is now drafting a policy statement, due out soon, that will include guidelines to make sure that tests of spaceborne systems, including antennas, are properly planned, conducted, and reported. The Office of Safety and Mission Quality has also established a Technical Standards Division. According to a NASA spokesman, spaceborne antennas will receive much attention. In the meantime, greater diligence is the standing order. Engineers scrutinized all seven antennas before allowing the latest communication satellite to be launched by the Space Shuttle in August. Michael Kakmar, writing in Microwaves and RF Magazine.
If you're considering buying one of the Philips DC777 shortwave car radios from Radiofax Sales, here's some very good news for you. After some hard bargaining with our suppliers, we're now able to offer these terrific shortwave car radios at the new lower price of only £239. And remember, not only is the DC777 a good quality digital readout shortwave tuner, it also has long wave, medium wave, FM stereo, a high quality stereo cassette deck and powerful stereo amplifier, all in a compact, standard size in-car unit. Shortwave coverage is from 3170 to 21910 kHz continuous. This unit receives a good review in the World Radio and TV Handbook and 4 stars in the Radio Netherlands receiver shopping list. The new low price, remember, is only £239, inclusive of VAT and delivery in the UK or overseas airmail to anywhere in the world. There's no long wait for your unit to arrive. We hold them in stock. Contact our sales office for more information and a brochure. Telephone number is in England. 0483 275 997. Fax number is also in England. 0483 276 477. Or write to us at Radio Fax, The Forge, Cranley, GU6 7BG in England.
And the special price of £239 is not going to be continued for very much longer, so get your order in soon to benefit from that price. We'll be right back.
Baby of the class, you know, you really didn't know.